Welcome back to another edition of the Berlin Journal, a production of the American Academy in Berlin and NPR Berlin. I'm RJ McGill. And on this edition, we'll be meeting several of the Academy Fellows who are living and working here this fall. Novelist Adam Hazlett is working on a new book during his time in Berlin. James Derderian is both a documentary filmmaker and a scholar of American foreign policy. During his time here, he's become embroiled in a local controversy over the naming of Ronald Reagan Platz, the square in front of the Brandenburg Gate where President Reagan made his most famous speech.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
About a year ago on the Berlin Journal, we heard from Executive Director Gary Smith about the Academy Villa here in Wannsee, the former residence of the prominent German banking family of Hans Arnhold. It occurred to us that many listeners might be unfamiliar with Wannsee, the tranquil lakeside suburb built up as a summer colony in the late 19th and early 20th century by some of Berlin's wealthiest families. On this edition, we'll hear about the Wannsee's history and pay a visit to two of its top tourist attractions. But first, a word or two from our resident poet Tom Slay, a New Yorker, author of 8 books of poetry. The most recent is titled Army Cats. This term, Slay, is the Anna Maria Kellen Fellow at the Academy, and on the evening when the new fellows introduced themselves to Berliners, Tom, with characteristic modesty, sought to place the art of poetry in perspective.
That reminded me of a story about the poet Swinburne. And one of Swinburne's admirers came up to him and said, "Oh, Mr. Swinburne, it must be terribly difficult writing poetry." Mm-hmm. And Swinburne said, "Oh, yes, it is terribly difficult. But the really hard part is knowing what to do with the other 23 and a half hours in the day."
At his October 25th reading at the Academy, Tom Slay shared a number of his recent poems with the Berlin audience. One of the most popular that evening was Space Station, a short poem about a mother, a dog, and being in outer space.
And in it, I imagine my mother's kitchen as a kind of space station. And if you've ever eaten my mother's cooking, you might also think that. But anyway, the poem takes place in the moment of weightlessness, presumably when space stations reverse and everything floats. My mother has a dog, or had a dog, lovely dog, wonderful dog. And but you know, when you look at a dog sometimes, and the dog looks at you, and you look at it, you have no idea what it's thinking. It's just like, whoa. My mother and I and the dog were floating weightless in the kitchen. Silverware hovered above the table. Napkins drifted just below the ceiling. The dead, who had been crushed by gravity, were free to move about the room, to take their place at supper, lift a fork, knife, spoon. A spoon, knife, fork that, outside this moment's weightlessness, would have been immovable as mountains. My mother and I and the dog were orbiting in the void that follows after happiness of an intimate gesture. Her hand stroking the dog's head and the dog looking up, expectant, into her eyes. The beast gaze so direct and alienly concerned to have its stare returned. The human gaze that forgets for a moment that it sees what it's seeing and simply fervently sees, but only for a moment. Only for a moment were my mother and the dog looking at each other, not mother or dog, but that look. I couldn't help but think, if only I were a dog, or mother was. Then that intimate gesture, this happiness passing, could last forever. Such a hopeful, hopeless wish I was wishing. I knew it and didn't know it, just as my mother knew she was my mother and didn't. And as for the dog, her large black pupils, fixed on my mother's faintly smiling face, seemed to contain a drop of the void we were all suspended in. Though only a dog who chews a ragged rawhide chew toy shaped into a bone, femur or cannon bone, of the heavy body that we no longer labor to lift against the miles-deep air pressing us to our chairs. The dog pricked her ears, sensing a dead one approaching. Crossing the kitchen, my father was moving with the clumsy gestures of a man in a spacesuit, the strangeness of death moving among the living, though the world was floating with a lightness that made us feel we were phantoms. I don't know if my mother saw him. He didn't look at her when he too put his hand on the dog's head and the dog turned its eyes from her stare to his. And then the moment on its axis reversed, the kitchen spun us the other way round and pressed heavy hands down on our shoulders so that my father sank into the carpet. My mother rested her chin on her hand and let her other hand slide off the dog's head, her knuckles bent in a kind of torment of moonscape erosion, ridging up into peaks giving way to seamed plains with names like the Sea of Tranquility. Though nothing but a metaphor for how I saw her hand, her empty, still strong hand, dangling all alone in the infinite space between the carpet and the neon-lit ceiling. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tom Slay, reading his poem Space Station from his 2007 book Spacewalk, published by Houghton Mifflin. A few days after Tom's reading, we sat down with him in the Academy's library to talk about what he believes happens when a poem is read aloud.
It's very much like Watt Frost said. He called it the sound of sense. And he said it's like if you're in a room and the door is shut and two people on the other side of the door are having an argument. Well, even without understanding their words, just by following the shifts in their vocal tones, you can tell pretty much who's winning, who's losing. And it strikes me that, you know, poetry has a preternatural ability to happen on many different levels, but when it's being read aloud, to happen on that other level, that kind of tonal level that goes way beyond, say, the kind of intellectualized content of the poem, the imagistic flash that it makes in the mind. All of those things happen, it seems to me, through the ear of the listener, and there's something incredibly direct and immediate about that. It strikes me as being really different than any other art form.
But can a reading really change the way we understand a poem?
I remember there was an older poet whose work I loved, a guy named Alan Dugan, and Alan was from Brooklyn, and Alan had a magnificent, orotund idiom, in the sense that when you read the poems on the page, they were full of these kind of wonderful O sounds. And when I read the poems on the page, I had this O, 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 and I thought that the poems were rather high, you know, in terms of the emotional tenor. And then Alan got out there and he began to read them, and he had a Brooklyn accent, and all the O's got flattened to A's. It was a sensational revelation for me at that moment. And suddenly, what had seemed very high was still high, but also had edge and grit.
Poet Tom Slay speaking with the Berlin Journal. Coming up, novelist Adam Hazlett. You're listening to the Berlin Journal from the American Academy in Berlin.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear from people who really make you think, like astrophysicist Brian Greene explaining the scientific theory that our universe is just one of many.
And the image that I like to have in mind is, imagine that our universe is like one slice of bread in a much grander cosmic loaf, with the other slices of bread being other universes.
No subject is too big for Fresh Air. Join us.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 104.1 FM.
Welcome back to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill.
My job is to create characters and take my reader as deeply into their minds and spirits as I possibly can. But in doing that, I'm portraying characters that are living in this troubled world that I'm describing.
Writer Adam Hazlett is a fellow here at the American Academy this fall. his best-selling 2010 novel Union Atlantic concerned the corrosive power of global finance on human relations. The book was written before the Lehman Brothers collapse in September 2008, which triggered the greatest financial calamity since the Great Depression. Hazlett sat down with American novelist Tara Bray Smith, who lives here in Berlin. In the course of their conversation, they touched upon the novel's attention to the flaws in the American financial system.
It wasn't my intent, obviously, as it couldn't have been, to write something out of the headlines. It was just, in a sense, my trying to imagine a way to grapple with this fact that we live in a society where there are these incredibly powerful but very poorly understood giant bureaucracies that have a tremendous influence on how our daily lives go and how everybody's lives go. And yet, the way we process information is one headline to the next and one flash of news and disaster after the next, and you don't really get a chance to see the picture framed for you of how these institutions work and how we relate to them. And so one ambition of the novel was to try to put characters, real people, in relation to those institutions.
In fact, there's a beautiful scene near the end of the book when Henry Graves, the person that you started with, I guess, and you say, or you, Henry quotes John Kenneth Galbraith, "The process by which banks create money is so simple, the mind is repelled. A deeper mystery seems only decent." And I thought this was a kind of a key to the book as a whole, in a way.
That quote was certainly one that floated around in my head, not just for that scene. Because as the force of the market and money as a source of valuation has penetrated deeper and deeper into more and more parts of our lives, and more parts of our lives are commodified in one way or another, and experience is commodified, that it's one of the most subjects that people end up thinking and caring the most about, but say
but
least about.
And not even the vocabulary.
Right, don't know the technical aspects of it, but also just as a psychological matter, I think we find it easier to talk about sex than we do about money. It's personally, one-to-one, you know, between friends or, in a family, but it's a source of huge meaning and conflict and everything else. And so, the fact that it's entirely man-made, right? That this is a created system that we actually have choices over.
Totally.
It's treated as natural law.
Right.
And it's treated as something that it's a beast we must feed, as opposed to a set of arrangements, human arrangements, that we've all made with each other. So I did want to, in a sense, set characters into time who were dwelling on that. The thing that interests me most about fiction is getting into other people's heads and the impossibility of complete intimacy with another person, that the challenge of getting all the way across the barrier.
impossible.
But I think that desire and the obstacles to it, I mean, that's what most good fiction, I think, is about. My goal is always to put the reader over the shoulder of the character, not to lecture them about
not
how
like
something.
A sack,
but in other words, allow the reader to look over the shoulder of the character so that they can, in a sense, just inhabit the world as if they're a fly on the wall. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the trouble with some fiction with a lot of technical stuff in it is that a writer stops and lectures the reader about a subject and then returns to the unfolding of the story. So my goal was always to just keep it close to the forward motion of it.
I think it was successful.
Well, thank you.
You gave a short talk recently at the Academy where you mentioned that a certain kind of irony that writers have relied on to critique the problems in their society, that ironic mode isn't working anymore. It's been co-opted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when I was talking about irony, I guess I was referring to the idea that I think different generations of writers come upon or seek out ways of finding an angle athwart the mainstream of the culture so that people can see it in a different light. It's fairly obvious. But irony, particularly sort of high postmodern irony, was the generation before me, I think, was the main tool. I think people like David Foster Wallace actually struggled with this as a question of how to go, because on the one hand he writes highly ironic material,
but it's so sincere.
But on the other hand, he's got a real interest in the emotional realities of the characters. So to me, the culture, and I mean advertising is the easiest place to see this, is so hip to irony, is so he manipulates it so readily and so well, really. And if you add that the YouTube and internet culture and the sort of withering ongoing critique of things minutes after they occur, right, then you're not really left as a fiction writer with a lot of purchase if you're just going to poke more holes.
Yeah.
So to me, in that kind of speed distraction culture, the more radical step is actually to slow down, create a space in which a person's attention might actually go in rather than sideways, you know, depth rather than lateral movement, then dwell with the another person's consciousness over a period of time. That sounds, on the one hand, like a fairly traditional goal of fiction or a more traditionally realist concept, which you could say it is, but then again, I mean, everybody's eclectic, and so it's as much what Proust is doing in making you absorbed in the world of his childhood as it is what Dickens is doing in describing English society. So the advantage that any writer has who's writing at any given moment is that they have everything that came before them as tools in the box.
Right.
My point there was that irony doesn't get us so far at the moment, I don't think.
So you're working on a new book.
Yeah.
Are you going more toward a single consciousness in this new book?
Well, I'm going towards first person. That's the main thing.
That's a big...
This was all written in close to the point of view of the characters, but third person.
Right.
And this is very much the voice of more than one character. Mm. So multiple first person voices.
Okay. That's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I can say from a purely non-content-based... I do feel... I'm a political junkie. I spend a lot of time reading and thinking about politics, and I write about politics. So it's very difficult not to, when I'm writing this book, have the press of events that are going on, particularly... I mean, these problems were there. The income gap was there. The beginning of... a real rent in the social fabric was there. It's just getting more and more dramatic and more ragged. So the book goes back in time a couple of decades and comes forward again. So it's not, I'm not writing a book about someone in the midst of foreclosure. But I am aware of those pressures because they're pressures on me and the people around me. And I think it's got to seep in, because I don't know how to hive off my waking life from my fiction life, in a sense, if fiction is a kind of dreaming state. I can't really divide those off. I think the impress of those, of the times we're in, will show up. Yeah.
The New York Times published a statistic. The top 1% of earners in the U.S. more than doubled their share of the nation's income over the last three decades. And you've called our current political financial system a culture of impunity. And yet everyone in Union Atlantic, with perhaps the exception of Jeffrey Holland, does face a kind of reckoning at the end of the book. Do you think the culture of impunity is changing at all? Do you think that the protests, the Occupy Wall Street, has done anything?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that things are, with this opening up of these questions, are you seeing that there's starting to be important change?
Well, I don't know if I wouldn't go so far as to say important change yet, but I think what you said just now is the right way to put it, the opening up of the questions. I mean, I think the very fact of the protests creates a point on the spectrum of how to discuss these issues that just wasn't there.
Right.
And so I think people are talking about the income gap. If you talked about that before, you were some crazy socialist. I think... it has had a positive change in the only way that eventually will change things, which is that people's base assumptions will begin to be examined. I think, how long can the bloody flag of class warfare be waved for anybody who wants to talk about the condition of most people's economic lives?
You mean what?
What Roosevelt used to call economic royalists,
yeah.
Proudly. He said, I consider them my enemies and I am proud of it. There's only so long that so many people can be suffering so much and not eventually speak from the point of their own interest. And I think this opens up that space.
So what do you see as fiction's role in addressing this time that you consider to be?
I think the role for me of fiction is in any point to expand the sphere of empathy and imaginative reach and people's capacity to live outside of their own lives and in someone else's head. And that extends to me to the people who we think we don't like. It's so simple to cast anybody who's in a position of leadership as a demon, and obviously there have been gross failures, but if I were just simply judging people, I wouldn't bother writing about them. So the people who I'm interested in writing about are people who somehow have a qualm or a question or conflict about why they're doing what they're doing.
Adam, thank you so much for talking to me.
Well, thank you for having me.
Novelist Adam Hazlett, a fellow at the American Academy in Berlin this fall, talking with Tara Bray Smith, author of the memoir West of Then, published by Simon & Schuster. During Hazlett's time here, he's working on a second novel, Kindness. You're listening to the Berlin Journal, and after the break, we'll explore the other side of Berlin's Lake Wannsee.
The world comes at you fast, on air, online, on your phone. There's an awful lot of information to process, and let's face it, your time is valuable. I'm Robert Siegel, and all things considered, we cut through the clutter, mining the data to separate the facts from the fluff. All things considered from NPR News, on the clock, every day.
Weeknights at 10 on 104.1 FM.
We're back with the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill. Producer Jeff Rosenberg has come to our Wannsee suburb many times over the past few years, but always just to the Academy. As we were planning this program, he could no longer contain his curiosity about what brings most visitors to this tranquil Berlin lakeside setting.
Wir erreichen jetzt den Bahnhof Berlin-Wannsee.
The cut-and-dried facts are these. Wannsee is the westernmost part of the city of Berlin. It's named after its two lakes, both called Wannsee. One is Großer, of course, the smaller of the two is called Kleiner. Population, roughly 9,000. The earliest known settlement on this site was called Stolpe, and it dates from at least 1299 AD, but it really wasn't the kind of place where you'd want to visit until a few hundred years later.
Before the late 19th century, this was only a forest and a lake. It was crossed by the first street in Prussia, the street between Potsdam and Berlin, because the Prussian king used to hurry between Potsdam and Berlin with his two castles. And you know, Friedrich der Große, preferred to stay in Potsdam, where he built his famous castle, Sanssouci.
Historian Norbert Kempe helped me get a better grasp of the history of the town. He's written a book on Wannsee's history, and he's also the director of the House on Wannsee Conference Memorial. More on that in a moment. So, by the late 19th century, there's this royal highway running right by the prime lakeside real estate of Wannsee. What does that suggest to you? As is so often the case,
some painters and authors discovered this area in the 19th century, and then rich people of Berlin discovered this area, especially this side of the lake where the House of the Wannsee Conference and also the Liebermann Villa are located, was bought by Mr. Conrad, who was a famous banker in Berlin, and he was a member of a so-called Club of Millionaires, after the famous model of clubs in London, and where the rich people of Berlin used to go. And he discussed with his fellow millionaires to construct here a marvelous area on the Lake Wannsee, on both sides, on the small Lake Wannsee and the big Lake Wannsee, with famous summer houses. And the idea was to have a marvelous pleasure ground with buildings in two styles, of the Italian Renaissance and of medieval style, neo-Gothic style. Yeah? And the first villas of the millionaires of Berlin here had not even central heating because they used to stay here only during summertime. And to have a good connection, they managed that the Wannseebahn, the railway station between the center of Berlin and Wannsee, was constructed, of course, with public financial support. The Berliners, they called it the millionaires' trains.
But although millionaires owned the lakeside villas, the railroad from the city made it easier for the average Berliner to have access to the beautiful warm lakes.
But also with the millionaires, there was a possibility for the average Berliner to come here and to have a bath in the Lake Wannsee. And so it was heavy discussed at that time here how to control this amoral bathing. When you see photos of that time in the newspapers, the ladies and the men did not look very amoral because there was no bikini or something like this. They had bathing shirts from the neck to the feet. Yeah? But this forced officials to construct the first spa.
Wannsee was still mostly a colony for the very wealthy, who built their villas by the lake and enjoyed the tranquil setting just an easy train ride away from Berlin. And Wannsee, from the beginnings of its golden age, seemed to be characterized by an atmosphere of tolerance. Again, Norbert Kempe.
Here in this area, according to all my findings, there was no difference whether you have been Jew or non-Jew. There was had been intermarriage strategies, and also banker Konrad, who established the whole infrastructure here, the streets and so on. He also founded a cemetery for people living here. And in the cemetery, you can find something you will never find in any other place in the world. You can find a tombstone with a family who had baptized, Jewish family who had baptized in the late 19th century. But giving respect to their origin, you can see the Mug and David and the Christian cross on the same tombstone. Mm-hmm. So this is a symbol for me. There was no problem here. For me, it was all the time fascinating that the Wannsee Conference, discussing how to deport all European Jews, happened here in this area where anti-Semitism was totally unknown.
Now, jump forward in time to January 1942. The villa built by the Maillet family was now in the hands of the Nazi security division and used primarily as a recreation and meeting center. Many of the fine villas of Wannsee were also occupied by organs of the Nazi state. In this stately villa, today called the House on Wannsee Conference Memorial and Educational Site, the Nazi High Command convened a meeting that set in motion one of the 20th century's greatest crimes, what the Nazis called the final solution. Even today, historians differ on exact reasons behind the decision by Hitler to mount the huge, complicated, and costly operations designed to exterminate all of Europe's Jews in the midst of wartime, rather than wait for what he believed would be the ultimate victory over the Allies. The United States had entered the war, and that meant the Nazi war machine had an even greater need for troops and weapons on all fronts. In spite of this, and apparently on Hitler's orders, it was decided to push ahead aggressively to deport and exterminate millions of Jews across Nazi-occupied Europe. To accomplish this, what was urgently needed was a unified operating plan for what we now call the Holocaust. Nazi Security Chief Reinhard Heydrich convened the conference in Wannsee on January 20, 1942. He was eager to exercise his newly consolidated power and to get all parties involved working from the same plan to accomplish Hitler's goal. Deportation was the euphemism the Nazis used for removal and genocide.
Euphemisms were widely used by all officers. So it was more pleasant to use such words. Mm-hmm. In summer 1941, Hermann Göring, the second after Hitler in the Nazi hierarchy, gave the order to him to plan an overall final solution. Today, we believe that after the mass murder of Soviet Jews was going on, in the moment when Hitler declared war against the United States in December 1941, he had made the decision that there will be no waiting until the final victory, but that the SS should organize the all-over deportation of European Jews. And this is what Heydrich wanted to organize here in this house. He wanted to give information to the civil participants that he is now the only one in charge to organize this. For a long time, as we had only the protocol, the conference, and not the access to archives in Eastern Europe, this was possible after the end of the Soviet Union, we as historians knew that before this date, January 20th, 1942, a decision must have been made that all European Jews should be deported and should not survive the end of the war.
At the meeting, Heydrich's Gestapo deputy, Adolf Eichmann, took the minutes, circulated the protocol that summarized the outcome of the meeting, and years later provided at his war crimes trial the details of what took place in about 90 minutes that winter morning in Wannsee. When you visit the House on Wannsee Conference Memorial, you will see one of the most comprehensive and well-organized exhibits of what led to the Holocaust and how this monstrous crime was planned and executed. That the lakeside villa setting for this atrocity was so pleasant and comfortable seems to make it even more incomprehensible. Over 100,000 visitors a year now come to the museum, which belongs to the city of Berlin. And many of those visitors also go to Wannsee's other featured attraction just a short stroll away, the Max Liebermann Villa.
My name is Martin Fass, and I'm the director of the Max Liebermann Villa at Wannsee. The Liebermann Villa at Wannsee is the former summer house of the painter Max Liebermann. As you look at our house, you will find that a lot of features of this house had its source in the architecture of the land houses at Hamburg.
Max Liebermann is not exactly a household name in many parts of the world, but it is in Germany. He and two close colleagues were Germany's most important painters in the late 19th and early 20th century. They were German Impressionism. In fact, for some art critics, Liebermann's work seems closest in spirit to that of the French painter Edouard Manet. Although he was born into a wealthy German-Jewish family, Max Liebermann became famous and very prosperous as a painter. And in the first decade of the 20th century, he bought one of the last available prime lots at Wannsee and built his own summer villa, modeled after the great mansions along the Elbe River in Hamburg. He was much sought after for his portraits, which he painted mainly in the city in the winter. But in summers, from 1914 onward, he concentrated on painting his magnificent gardens at his home in Wannsee. His colors are bright and luminous and eternal as those of any of his French contemporaries. Now, after many years of effort, that house and its gardens have been restored and opened to the public as a museum for many of his works, as well as a recreation of the original gardens. Martin Fass is the museum's director.
It is a very special garden architecture. That is not the English garden people loved before. Bart Liebermann was not interested in that. He said, I want to have a formal garden like the English gardens before wars. And it was very important for him to have an architectural shape in his garden design. And so he combined different garden spaces, vegetable garden, a garden with perennials, a flower terrace, and on the right side of the garden you see the birch alley. With birches, Max Liebermann found on his property when he bought the property. Now, a lot of birches are standing in the middle of the of the way to Wannsee, and it is very special, a very special characteristic of this garden. And on the left side you have the hedge gardens, and the rose garden, and another garden with lime trees. And you see a very special concept behind this garden plan.
These two great houses now stand restored and renewed for visitors to see the Wannsee that once was, the birthplace of the everlasting nightmare of the Holocaust, and the transcendent beauty of the gardens and the art that Max Liebermann brought to life. Again, Martin Voss.
A fact I'm glad about is that a lot of people visiting the House of the Wannsee Conference are coming to our house as well, because they have the chance to see different aspects of dealing with our own history. The one you see at the Haus der Wannsee Conference, you see a documentary exhibition of what was in the Nazi era here in Berlin and in Europe as well. And here in the Wannsee Villa of Max Liebermann, you can see what was before. You are able to see what treasures of our own history are destroyed. And it shows that such a house had the chance to rescue the memory to a very important part of Berlin history, to show its value and the treasures of that time, and to demonstrate what was happened later.
That visit to Wannsee's attractions from producer Jeff Rosenberg. You're listening to the Berlin Journal. We're back with the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill. James Derderian is both a documentary filmmaker and a professor of international relations at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. During his time as a fellow here in Berlin, Derderian was accidentally drawn into a kind of diplomatic incident that changed the very nature of what he came to Berlin to do.
Well, it was a series of fortuitous accidents. And in many ways, the event itself, which was the decision, the attempt to name a street or a square after Ronald Reagan, came to me in a very roundabout way. I'd originally come to the American Academy to do research. That was not to be. When you come to the Academy, first of all, you're in a strange land and a strange place. So that defamiliarizes you. You already are a little bit off-center. You're thinking, okay, what should I do today? And they have people here who will tell you what you should do. One of them is a wonderful individual at the American Academy, Malta, who runs their press relations. And he said, we'd like you to do an op-ed piece for the Berliner Zeitung. And he said, by the way, you need to do it in 3 days. So I'm racking my brain, which was pretty foggy from jet lag, and I'm thinking, okay, it's coming up to the 50th anniversary in 3 days of that famous farewell address by President Eisenhower, the general turned president, who had warned the American public about the rise of a military-industrial complex. So I thought this would be a good opportunity to talk about Eisenhower. So I had been strolling around Berlin trying to get oriented, and I came across, believe it or not, John Foster Dulles. I had come across, of course, Trumanstrasse. So I discovered all these streets in Berlin named after individual Americans who figured large in the history of Berlin. You had streets named after the military governor, Clay. You had, of course, a street, I think several, a school, a kindergarten named after John F. Kennedy. And so I was scratching my head trying to find that little hook, you know, we all do in an op-ed piece, that would interest Berlin to why they should be worried about a military-industrial complex 50 years later. And I thought, well, maybe it's time to name a street after Eisenhower. And then the deeper I got in, it was like sort of going down the rabbit hole. You came up with all this evidence that, well, maybe it wasn't just an oversight. Maybe it was because he didn't allow Patton to make that dash to Berlin. He was the one who really stood by the agreements with the Soviets and allowed them to come to Berlin first, and we know the consequences of that. Brutal occupation, as we know. And the sort of sequential events after that, leading up to 1961, with the confrontation that led to the Berlin Wall, was the setting for President Kennedy coming and giving his famous speech, Ich bin ein Berliner. It was quite a remarkable moment that then President Reagan decided to replicate many, many years later, in 1987, when he came and stood in front of the Brandenburg Gate and Pariser Platz, and famously said to Mr. Gorbachev, open these gates, tear down this wall. This speech prompted various groups, lobbies in the United States to bring a new street to Berlin, a Ronald Reagan Strasse. I was drawn into this controversy because Der Spiegel wrote an op-ed saying, isn't it time we have a Ronald Reagan Strasse? The problem was the opening sentences, indeed the opening paragraph, was almost word for word for my opening for the op-ed piece for Berliner Zeitung the previous month. So they had said, you know, we have a street named after Kennedy, we have a street named after Truman, why don't we have a street named after Ronald Reagan? So I got in a very, almost like a parallel universe, drawn into this going side by side with the controversy, not wanting to be involved. But then I was receiving phone calls through the American Academy whether or not I would be willing to go on camera and say something about this controversy, because I, after all, was the expert on Berlin streets, which is, of course, a myth. And but I'm always willing to play, if not the fool, play, you know, to the crowd, in this case, playing to an audience that I think wanted to have some sort of counterbalance to this incredible pressure. Because these foundations, some connected to the Reagan Library, some connected to the effort to lower taxes, one run by Ronald Reagan's son, were they had deep pockets, and they were very successful. They got a 10-meter statue put up outside the American Embassy in London. They had plaques and streets in various Central European, Eastern European capitals named after Reagan. So they thought it would be a, you know, cakewalk. They come to Berlin. This is a natural place for Reagan, you know, the man who brought freedom, who ended the Cold War. This was the, you know, the litany we've heard. And that there should not be too much resistance. Well, I became a pawn in some ways, but also a player in that I, in a series of interviews, but one that I think reached the world through Deutsche Welle, which is the equivalent of, I guess, the BBC, picked me up and they said, we would like you to do a tour of Berlin on camera with commentary with the press attaché from the American Embassy, which was Mitchell Moss, wonderful, interesting fellow. So I thought, fine, that'd be nice, you know, sort of give and take. However, when I arrived outside the American Embassy, Mitch had already done his stand-up and gone back into the embassy. So I thought, this is a little peculiar. I said, I thought we were going to have a dialogue. And they said, well, we'll construct a dialogue. That's what editing's for. So we went to Rosa Luxemburg Strasse, and I did a stand-up there and talked about how, you know, Rosa Luxemburg, the great leader of the Spartacist uprising, gets a street name in Berlin. Why is this? What does it mean? How is, in some ways, a communist, radical, revolutionary normalized in this process of naming of a street? But the reason why I think I got caught in this sort of quantum moment where, you know, the media's eye kept changing the sort of path of events is because the local municipalities, which is some people might know and others might be listening to this don't, is that they have the authority to name a street, to change the name of a street. So even though the Chancellor Merkel and the, at the time, Defense Minister Gutenberg had been strong advocates of making this street change. So from the top, this was Prussia. The local municipality was run by the Social Democrats, the Left Party, and they took a vote and said no. So when they couldn't get a street or a plaza, a Platz square named after Reagan in the middle of Berlin, by, you know, Pariser Platz and by the gate itself, they started looking for a municipality that had more conservatives. And one was by Kudamm in Charlottenburg. That municipality had more conservatives. But they lost there as well. So when I was asked to do this sort of stand-up all through the streets of Berlin, I was partially doing a commentary on what had just happened, but also to possibly be used as ammunition against the next effort. And what did this illustrate? What did this demonstrate? One, it shows how important I think the media is increasingly in not just local politics, but, you know, global politics. We saw how social media can have an impact in uprisings in the Arab Spring. But at a local level, we saw the boundary become very diffuse between local politics, state politics, global politics. And it was also a lesson for me because I, as a documentary filmmaker, I know that reality is created often in an editing room. How, what you put in, what you leave out, who you have on camera, what questions you ask. And so I was sort of reflexively, while these interviews were going on, thinking about the process, and I realized, would they really create a dialogue? And the final piece, which was, you know, very good, very, I thought, high production values, smartly edited, but there's a little bit of gotcha journalism in the piece. And I don't like gotcha journalism too much, but I understand why they did it. But what was interesting is how they took my words and basically manipulated them to make me become the sort of good guy and Mitch Moss the bad guy in this. And I was the guy who said, you know, I thought that there should be a Ronald Reagan Platz and it should be in the middle of Berlin. And they did this just to set up Mitch Moss. The only problem is I never said that on camera. They had a woman's voiceover say it. What I had said, after constant prodding from the director, was, yeah, okay, if you're going to have a street, don't hide it away somewhere. Do put it in the center of Berlin so it'll have a constant controversy. And it'll be about, you know, who was Reagan the man? You know, Reagan the man, not Reagan the myth, was something that I thought, as a provocation, this might be a good thing. But I said it in a very sardonic tone. So instead of having my tone, they had this woman make it sound like a very serious statement. So poor Mitch, you know, gets sort of broadsided by this, and he was smart. He realized this was a moment where the piece pivoted. So instead of immediately answering, he looks very confused in the clip, and then he burst out laughing. It was a wonderful moment because he realized he was being punked. I don't know if that translates into German, but it's sort of like when you're being ambushed. So he laughed, and he said, well, that's ridiculous, you know. And he said, we're not going to have a Ronald Reagan Platz here. Pariser Platz has been named this for like 300-odd years. It's not going to change. But of course, and then he did his party line, the embassy line, we would welcome any recognition of President Reagan's accomplishments in Berlin. Nice, neutral, anodyne response to a gotcha moment. So the piece is sort of an interesting construction of how you know, politics gets converted into a media play. So I call this phenomenon quantum diplomacy. And this is what I ended up doing at the American Academy. Instead of doing my ebook, I wrote a long piece. It's called Quantum Diplomacy, German-American Relations, A Psychogeography of Berlin. And the references are threefold. Quantum diplomacy was actually first coined by Secretary of State Shultz when he was caught up in this experience of trying to negotiate, you know, arms reductions, nuclear arms reductions, with a fellow arms control expert who was a physicist, a pretty well-known physicist, who together they came up with this term to say, you know, as soon as you stick a camera in front of something in the way that sort of the Heisenberg principle works, as soon as you try to observe something, you cannot basically pin down that particle, that electron. And I decided to appropriate that concept to understand German-American relations from this small little snapshot and show how the whole idea of diplomacy of the past Well, you know, states have accredited individuals who go from capital to capital, enjoy, you know, certain privileges, immunities. Their job has in many ways been diluted. But why I seized on this idea of a psychogeography, which might grate on the ears of some of your listeners, is because it's a concept that was coined by the Situationist in the 50s and 60s, the French Situationist whose ideas were then in turn appropriated by the 68 generation. And their idea of a psychogeography came from a French concept of détournement, which roughly translates as hijack. You take an idea and you hijack it for your own purposes. So I wanted to hijack this idea of, you know, Reaganizing Berlin. And I was in some ways a streetwalker. You know, I was going, drifting through the streets, taking a lot of photographs. And I was kind of just staying open to my environment, but also the environment was then shaping my thinking in that way that a psychogeography, psycho being mind, geography having an impact on the mind. And the end result is I had a new appreciation for how we can just sort of walk through familiar surroundings, but it's only when you take yourself out of something you're, you know, habitually comfortable with that you start to look at it afresh. And that's what I wanted to do with this piece. I wanted people to look at not Berlin streets, but go back and look at your own streets. You know, you have often this view that a city is cut from whole cloth. You're designing a city in this swamp in Washington that you then have a grid system, you name it after something everybody can agree upon, you know, like, you know, numbers or states, you know, so Connecticut. It's changing. I mean, now you see secondary street names. You know, we now have Martin Luther King streets in many major metropolitan areas. But usually it's pretty non-controversial figures. And how you take controversial figures and make them normal through this sort of process of just walking. You know, I'm walking through the streets. And that makes this person acceptable and even considered to be estimable, having high esteem. And that I had to leave the United States to kind of get that kind of new worldview.
James Derderian is a Bosch Public Policy Fellow at the American Academy. Stateside, he's a documentary filmmaker and a professor at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. The Berlin Journal is a production of the American Academy in Berlin and National Public Radio. To learn more about the fellows at the American Academy in Berlin, visit our website, americanacademy.de, and for more on NPR Berlin, you can go to nprberlin.de. Our production team includes Jeff Rosenberg and Peter Solomon in Berlin and Sarah Richards in Washington. I'm your host, RJ McGill. Thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal.